In today's episode, we will look at myths of management from Chapter 2 of the book, The Great Game of Business by Jack Stack. Hello and welcome. This book club podcast is for teams tackling issues of both human capital and financial capital, especially now in the wake of mass automation, not only of factory and retail jobs, but also displacement of white-collar work too. I'm Esther Tang, an avid reader and entrepreneur in the automotive space. Almost a decade ago, I came across SRC, a wildly successful company in Missouri, USA. SRC harnesses human participation in an extraordinary all-hands-on-deck method that they call the Great Game of Business, or GGOB. It's a surprisingly fun and effective business operating system that's been quietly helping hundreds of businesses to leapfrog ahead. If you're like me, and you think our country and the world can plan better for today's rapidly reshaping workforces, if you want to remain respectful of all workers, even those inevitably displaced by automation, e-commerce, and other tech innovations, then please join me in this chapter-by-chapter discussion of the Great Game of Business operating system. We all know how sometimes there's simply bad teaching that is perpetuated from one generation to another. It continues until one day someone wakes up and says, "By golly, there's a much better way to do something." Human history is littered with such examples. In the colonial period, doctors used leeches to bleed the bad blood out of patients. In the medieval period, to build a cathedral or a grand mosque, thousands of indentured servants were forced into hard labor, and almost none of them would live to see the final product. Feudalism was once considered a viable social structure. But as we saw in Downton Abbey, Lord Grantham and his peers were forced to change as their society's awareness shifted post-war. Need I go on? My hunch is that a specific approach can work beautifully for a while, even for hundreds of years. But in time, the method loses its connection with what the people need and believe. Slowly but surely, old ways of doing things become no longer as useful. Eventually, the gravitational pull of society moves in a certain direction, whether due to advancements in science, like the invention of penicillin, or shifts in a scripture's interpretation, for example, views on polygamy. Likewise, change occurs also in how we do business and manage teams. Chapter 2 highlights what Jack Stack calls four myths of management. In my opinion, these four myths are examples of management methods turned stale and out of date, especially for a developed economy looking to survive and thrive through an industrial revolution. And as we all know, today we are currently living through the fourth industrial revolution. Let's discuss the four myths from Chapter 2. Myth number one: don't tell people the truth, or else they'll use it against you. Myth number two: the manager's job is to come up with answers. Myth number one: don't tell people the truth, or else they'll use it against you. The crux of this reasoning is that being transparent with others about your needs makes you vulnerable. And inevitably, the vulnerability becomes a liability. The manufacturing example in the book that Jack Stack remembers from his past experience between the parts purchasing team and the assembly line, which he managed, well, without enough parts, an assembly line cannot operate. It shuts down. When a young Jack started his job at 19 years old, The common practice for assembly line managers was to keep secret exactly when their part supply would fall too low. Jack was advised to flat out lie about his numbers. For example, if he had enough volume to last 2 to 3 weeks, he should act as if they would run out by Friday. However, something in Jack told him to go the other way. Instead of following the well-intentioned advice to lie, Jack decided to try the truth. He decided to give facts and figures based on reality. The outcome was not the nightmare backstabbing scenario that his supervisor had forewarned. Instead, those who worked with Jack realized that they could rely on his words, which meant they could rely on his word. They could trust him. And what a world of difference trust makes. We only need to think about relationships gone awry because one person didn't assume the best about another. By assuming the worst in each other, trust shrivels. A lot of mental energy is needed when attempting to interpret the words, behaviors, and intentions of an ambiguous frenemy. So why not just be clear to begin with? I recently read a book on adult attachment theory by researchers Amir Levine and Rachel Heller. Their model divides people into 3 broad categories of attachment: anxious, avoidant, and secure. Anxious attached people exhibit needy behavior when threatened. The more triggered they are, the more they seek reassurance in the form of incessant texts, phone calls, and needing to be talked down from the emotional ledge. They have a strong need to hear, on repeat, phrases such as, "You are my number one. I will never leave you. I love you. I will never leave you. I love you. I will never leave you." It's pretty tiring to be in a relationship with an anxious attached person. Now, the avoidant attached people, they become emotionally and physically distant when triggered. The more they feel threatened, the quicker they are to close off their hearts and create physical and emotional distance. They often secretly pine after a phantom perfect ex-girlfriend or boyfriend, someone who, no surprise, is always coincidentally unavailable. Like an obsessed nomad, the avoidant attached person chases after a mirage. But for those in the third category, those called secure attached, when these people feel threatened, they engage in effective, clear communication. They plainly express what they feel. The secure attached person can pair with either of the category members. This is because the secure attached person has the communication skills to smooth out the rough patches. But if neither party is a secure attached person, turmoil ensues. This turmoil is basically the net effect of myth one. If we assume that other people are out to harm us, and our go-to strategy is to further muddle the communication, such as through lying, then the workplace becomes a nest of triggered, anxious, avoidant people. You would agree that this would not be an atmosphere that anyone, short of a masochist or saint, would wake up on a Monday morning wanting to dive into. Myth number two, management's job is to come up with the answers. This sounds to me like the logic of parenting superimposed onto the workplace. The parent has more life experience than the child, so of course the parent should set the strategy and divvy out tasks and chores for the child. Now, I'm not a parent myself. However, I've observed many parent-child relationships and see that this model of command and control is relevant mostly when kids are toddlers and younger. After a certain level of self-awareness develops, The child starts to gain abilities like self-regulation, social skills, and reasoning. As this continues in life, the parent's role seems to become less of a micromanager and more of an advisor and source of judicious reward and punishment. Think of a kid you know who is mature beyond his years. Now, think of the primary caretakers in that kid's life. My bet is that those parents taught the kid responsibility by giving him responsibility, not by doing everything for him, but by letting the child get out there and learn. I'm sure this is terrifying for parents, but the downside risk for humans with stunted emotional growth is so terrible that it is worth an overprotective helicopter parent's angst to allow her child degrees of freedom. Ultimately, if this young person goes through his tweens, teens, and beyond without responsibility, self-esteem, self-reliance, and ability to negotiate and get along with others, he or she is not unsalvageable. It won't be game over. But eventually, an emotionally stunted person learns through very harsh means how society views him. The emotionally non-fluent individual gets relegated to the margins. For a social species like humans are, emotional isolation feels incredibly cruel and debilitating. It's hard to make a comeback from social isolation, or worse, from ostracization. So in the workplace, degrees of freedom and responsibility look like what? It means carrying the real burden of knowing the facts about where we are going, why, and how we will get there. In Chapter 2, there are two excellent real-life examples from Jack's life. Whereas the out-of-date management belief was to not tell workers just how bad things were, when the factory was in a serious pickle, Jack told everyone, and he used the hive mind to identify a winning solution. I know this could sound basic to many listeners who regularly use the hive mind, be it sorting through Amazon ratings or posting an open question online. I myself use Facebook Hive Mind all the time for things as simple as travel tips. In Jack's example of crowdsourcing solutions from his team instead of solely from his own mind, workers around him were on strike. They were angry and sniping with real guns at anyone driving in and out of the factory. Jack put the problem clearly before the whole group. And what they came up with sounds like a bank heist movie. You see, the factory needed to somehow bring in steel to build their tractors. But how could they do that if snipers lined the roads specifically looking to shoot and disrupt? The solution was this: load steel into school buses driven by nuns. Not actual nuns, but their own colleagues wearing crosses, habits, and pretending they had 2X chromosomes. And the plan worked. I sure wish, and I'm betting you do too, I sure wish that we could see footage of this plan in action. There are all sorts of anthems that this type of creative guts support. Anyway, the point is, a manager's job is to tap into the collective hive mind. And a healthy hive mind begins with an atmosphere of trust and clear communication. This disproves myth number 2, that a manager's job is to come up with all the answers. Now, the example Jack gives of crisis communication is also worth talking about. The factory had a target to build 800 tractors in 1 month. The customer contract included a daily penalty clause for late deliveries. 800 tractors might not sound too daunting until you realize that their daily rate was between 3 to 7 tractors. So what did the guys in the plant do? As you might have guessed, Jack's superiors told him not to tell anyone that they were in a crisis. Don't let anyone know that there's a huge target of 800 tractors. Just let everyone focus on your narrow task and hope to God the numbers will add up. Of course, for Jack, someone whose default belief in people is that they want to do a good job, they want to find solutions, and that they are capable of critical thinking, Jack tells his entire team that they have a target of 800 tractors. What happens next? The hive quickly identifies a bottleneck between the loading dock and warehouse. They fix it. Parts then arrive on the assembly line faster. Next, the hive determines how to improve the speed of delivery of key components. One big problem gets broken down into smaller chunks. As each chunk is conquered, the hive increases its confidence, its view of itself, its respect of each other. The team increases its might. And here's where the magic happens. When people's eyes open up to the limitless upside that exists when they work together, a feeling of united purpose grows. Something bigger than any one person enters the picture. People don't want to let each other down, not out of fear, but out of respect and care for the group. Individualism takes a backseat. The great game of business system shows that a manager's top priority should be guiding the team to a place where they increase respect for each other and for what they can build together. This sounds quasi-divine to me. Jack Stack, someone who by age 19 had been kicked out of seminary, college, the military, and General Motors for playing poker during work hours, he might seem like an unlikely source of a quasi-divine message. Or maybe he is just the right guy in a nun's outfit for the job. And that's it for this episode. Remember to use real facts and figures with your colleagues. It lets them know that they can trust your word. And more trust within a team leads to a group that respects itself. Also, remember that a leader's goal is not to come up with all the answers. Instead, tap into the hive mind of your team. The whole is truly greater than the sum of its parts. Let me know how things go. My email is et55@cornell.edu, or you can tweet me at @tangy_turbo. Thank you for taking the time to listen. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, rate and review, and tell a friend. Thank you to Jack Stack, author of The Great Game of Business. Thank you to the many people at SRC and other companies who already use The Great Game. Thank you to my family for encouraging me to connect with others on the pressing issues of our time. And thank you, my inquisitive listeners, for giving serious, deliberate thought towards our future. Signing off until next chapter, I'm Esther Tang. Remember that you count and you matter to me.